The Dark Tower 4, Wizard and Glass, by Stephen King. Narrated by Frank Muller. Argument. Wizard and Glass is the fourth volume of a longer tale inspired by Robert Browning's narrative poem, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. The first volume, The Gunslinger, tells how Roland of Gilead pursues and at last catches Walter, the man in black, who pretended friendship with Roland's father but who actually served Martin, a great sorcerer. Catching the half-human Walter is not Roland's goal, but only a means to an end. Roland wants to reach the Dark Tower, where he hopes the quickening destruction of Midworld may be halted, perhaps even reversed. Roland is a kind of knight, the last of his breed, and the tower is his obsession, his only reason for living when first we meet him. We learn of an early test of manhood forced upon him by Martin, who has seduced Roland's mother. Martin expects Roland to fail this test and to be sent west, his father's guns forever denied him. Roland, however, lays Martin's plans at nines, passing the test, due mostly to his clever choice of weapon. We discover that the gunslinger's world is related to our own in some fundamental and terrible way. This link is first revealed when Roland meets Jake, a boy from the New York of 1977 at a desert way station. There are doors between Roland's world and our own. One of them is death, and that is how Jake first reaches Midworld, pushed into 43rd Street, and run over by a car. The pusher was a man named Jack Mort, except the thing hiding inside of Mort's head and guiding his murderous hands on this particular occasion was Roland's old enemy, Walter. Before Jake and Roland reach Walter, Jake dies again, this time because the gunslinger, faced with an agonizing choice between this symbolic sun and the Dark Tower, chooses the tower. Jake's last words before plunging into the abyss are, "Go then. There are other worlds than these." The final confrontation between Roland and Walter occurs near the Western Sea. In a long night of palaver, the man in black tells Roland's future with a strange tarot deck. Three cards, the prisoner, the lady of the shadows, and death, but not for you, gunslinger, are especially called to Roland's attention. The second volume, The Drawing of the Three, begins on the edge of the Western Sea, not long after Roland awakens from his confrontation with his old nemesis and discovers Walter long dead, only more bones in a place of bones. The exhausted gunslinger is attacked by a horde of carnivorous lobstrosities, and before he can escape them, he has been seriously wounded, losing the first two fingers of his right hand. He is also poisoned by their bites, and as he resumes his trek northward along the Western Sea, Roland is sickening, perhaps dying. On his walk, he encounters three doors, standing freely on the beach. These open into our city of New York at three different whens. From 1987, Roland draws Eddie Dean, a prisoner of heroin. From 1964, he draws Odetta Susanna Holmes, a woman who has lost her lower legs in a subway mishap, one that was no accident. She is indeed a lady of shadows, with a vicious second personality hiding within the socially committed young black woman her friends know. This hidden woman, the violent and crafty Detta Walker, is determined to kill both Roland and Eddie when the gunslinger draws her into Midworld. Between these two in time, once again in 1977, Roland enters the hellish mind of Jack Mort, who has hurt Odetta Detta not once, but twice. "Death," the man in black told Roland, "but not for you, gunslinger." Nor is Mort the third of whom Walter foretold. Roland prevents Mort from murdering Jake Chambers, and shortly afterward, Mort dies beneath the wheels of the same train which took Odetta's legs in 1959. Roland thus fails to draw the psychotic into mid-world, but, he thinks, who would want such a being in any case? Yet there's a price to be paid for rebellion against a foretold future. Isn't there always? "Caw, maggot," Roland's old teacher, Cort, might have said. "Such is the great wheel and always turns. Be not in front of it when it does, or you'll be crushed under it and so make an end to your stupid brains and useless bags of guts and water." Roland thinks that perhaps he has drawn three in just Eddie and Odetta, since Odetta is a double personality. Yet when Odetta and Detta merge as one in Susanna, thanks in large part to Eddie Dean's love and courage, the gunslinger knows it's not so. He knows something else as well. He is being tormented by thoughts of Jake, the boy who, dying, spoke of other worlds. Half of the gunslinger's mind, in fact, believes there never was a boy. In preventing Jack Mort from pushing Jake in front of the car meant to kill him, Roland has created a temporal paradox which is tearing him apart. And in our world, it is tearing Jake Chambers apart as well. The Wastelands, the third volume of the series, begins with this paradox. After killing a gigantic bear named either Mir by the old people who went in fear of it, or Shardik by the great old ones who built it, for the bear turns out to be a cyborg, Roland, Eddie, and Susanna backtrack the beast and discover the path of the beam. There are six of these beams running between the 12 portals which mark the edges of Midworld. At the point where the beams cross, at the center of Roland's world, perhaps the center of all worlds, the gunslinger believes that he and his friends will at last find the Dark Tower. By now, Eddie and Susanna are no longer prisoners in Roland's world. In love, and well on the way to becoming gunslingers themselves, they are full participants in the quest and follow him willingly along the path of the beam. In a speaking ring, not far from the portal of the bear, time is mended, paradox is ended, and the real third is at last drawn. Jake re-enters mid-world at the conclusion of a perilous rite where all four, Jake, Eddie, Susanna, and Roland, remember the faces of their fathers and acquit themselves honorably. Not long after, the quartet becomes a quintet when Jake befriends a Billy Bumbler. Bumblers, which look like a combination of badger, raccoon, and dog, have a limited speaking ability. Jake names his new friend Oi. The Way of the Pilgrims leads them toward Ludd, an urban wasteland where the degenerate survivors of two old factions, the Pubes and the Greys, carry on the vestige of an old conflict. Before reaching the city, they come to a little town called River Crossing, where a few antique residents still remain. They recognize Roland as a remnant of the old days before the world moved on, and honor him and his companions. After, the old people tell them of a monorail train, which may still run from Ludd and into the wastelands, along the path of the beam and toward the Dark Tower. Jake is frightened by this news, but not really surprised. Before being drawn away from New York, he obtained two books from a bookstore owned by a man with the thought-provoking name of Calvin Tower. One is a book of riddles with the answers torn out. The other, Charlie the Choo-Choo, is a children's book about a train. An amusing little tale, most might say. But to Jake, there's something about Charlie that isn't amusing at all. Something frightening. Roland knows something else. In the high speech of his world, the word char means death. Aunt Talitha, the matriarch of the River Crossing folk, gives Roland a silver cross to wear, and the travelers go their course. Before reaching Ludd, they discover a downed plane from our world, a German fighter from the 1930s. Jammed into the cockpit is the mummified corpse of a giant, almost certainly the half-mythical outlaw David Quick. While crossing the dilapidated bridge which spans the River Send, Jake and Oi are nearly lost in an accident. While Roland, Eddie, and Susanna are distracted by this, the party is ambushed by a dying and very dangerous outlaw named Gasher. He abducts Jake and takes him underground to the TikTok Man, the last leader of the Greys. TikTok's real name is Andrew Quick. He is the great-grandson of the man who died trying to land an airplane from another world. While Roland, aided by Oi, goes after Jake, Eddie and Susanna find the Cradle of Lud, where Blaine the Mono awakes. Blaine is the last above-ground tool of the vast computer system which lies beneath the city of Lud, and it has only one remaining interest: riddles. It promises to take the travelers to the monorail's final stop if they can solve a riddle it poses them. Otherwise, Blaine says, the only trip they'll be taking will be to the place where the path ends in the clearing. To their deaths, in other words. In that case, they'll have plenty of company, for Blaine is planning to release stocks of nerve gas which will kill everyone left in Lud, pubes, greys, and gunslingers alike. Roland rescues Jake, leaving the TikTok Man for dead, but Andrew Quick is not dead. Half-blind, hideously wounded about the face, he is rescued by a man who calls himself Richard Fannin. Fannin, however, also identifies himself as the Ageless Stranger, a demon of whom Roland has been warned by Walter. Roland and Jake are reunited with Eddie and Susanna in the Cradle of Lud, and Susanna, with a little help from dat bitch, Detta Walker, is able to solve Blaine's riddle. They gain access to the Mono, of necessity ignoring the horrified warnings of Blaine's sane but fatally weak undermind. Eddie calls this voice Little Blaine, only to discover that Blaine means to commit suicide with them aboard. The fact that the actual mind running the Mono exists in computers falling farther and farther behind them, running beneath a city which has become a slaughtering pen, will make no difference when the pink bullet jumps the track somewhere along the line at a speed in excess of 800 miles an hour. There is only one chance of survival: Blaine's love of riddles. Roland of Gilead proposes a desperate bargain. It is with this bargain that the Wastelands ends. It is with this bargain that Wizard and Glass begins. Romeo. Lady, by yonder blessed moon I vow, that tips with silver all these fruit tree tops. Juliet, oh, swear not by the moon, then constant moon, that monthly changes in her circled orb, lest that thy love prove likewise variable. Romeo, what shall I swear by? Juliet, do not swear at all. Or, if thou wilt, swear by thy gracious self, which is the god of my idolatry, and I'll believe thee. Romeo and Juliet, William Shakespeare. On the fourth day, to Dorothy's great joy, Oz sent for her, and when she entered the throne room, he greeted her pleasantly.
Sit down, my dear. I think I have found a way to get you out of this country.
And back to Kansas? She asked eagerly.
Well, I'm not sure about Kansas, said Oz, for I haven't the faintest notion which way it lies.
The Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum. I asked one draft of earlier, happier sights, ere fitly I could hope to play my part. Think first, fight afterwards, the soldier's art. One taste of the old time sets all to rights. Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. Robert Browning. Prologue. Blaine.
Ask me a riddle,
Blaine invited. Fuck you, Roland said. He did not raise his voice.
What do you say?
In its clear disbelief, the voice of Big Blaine had become very close to the voice of its unsuspected twin.
I said, fuck you,
Roland said calmly, but if that puzzles you, Blaine, I can make it clearer. No. The answer is no. There was no reply from Blaine for a long, long time, and when he did respond, it was not with words. Instead, the walls, floor, and ceiling began to lose their color and solidity again. In a space of 10 seconds, the Barony coach once more ceased to exist. They were now flying through the mountain range they had seen on the horizon. Iron gray peaks rushed toward them at suicidal speed, then fell away to disclose sterile valleys where gigantic beetles crawled about like landlocked turtles. Roland saw something that looked like a huge snake suddenly uncoil from the mouth of a cave. It seized one of the beetles and yanked it back into its lair. Roland had never in his life seen such animals or countryside, and the sight made his skin want to crawl right off his flesh. Blaine might have transported them to some other world. "Perhaps I should derail us here," Blaine said. His voice was meditative, but beneath it the gunslinger heard a deep, pulsing rage. "Perhaps you should," the gunslinger said indifferently. Eddie's face was frantic. He mouthed the words, "What are you doing?" Roland ignored him. He had his hands full with Blaine, and he knew perfectly well what he was doing. "You are rude and arrogant," Blaine said. "These may seem like interesting traits to you, but they are not to me." "Oh, I can be much ruder than I have been." Roland of Gilead unfolded his hands and got slowly to his feet. He stood on what appeared to be nothing, legs apart, his right hand on his hip, and his left on the sandalwood grip of his revolver. He stood as he had so many times before, in the dusty streets of 100 forgotten towns, in a score of rocky canyon killing zones, in unnumbered dark saloons with their smells of bitter beer and old fried meals. It was just another showdown in another empty street. That was all, and that was enough. It was Kef, Ka, and Ka-Tet. That the showdown always came was the central fact of his life, and the axle upon which his own Ka revolved. That the battle would be fought with words instead of bullets this time made no difference. It would be a battle to the death just the same. The stench of killing in the air was as clear and definite as the stench of exploded carrion in a swamp. Then the battle rage descended as it always did, and he was no longer really there to himself at all. "I can call you a nonsensical, empty-headed, foolish machine. I can call you a stupid, unwise creature who senses no more than the sound of a winter wind in a hollow tree." "Stop it!" Roland went on in the same serene tone, ignoring Blaine completely. "You're what Eddie calls a gadget. Were you more, I might be ruder yet." "I am a great deal more than just I could call you a sucker of cocks, for instance, but you have no mouth. I could say you're viler than the vilest beggar who ever crawled the lowest street in creation, but even such a creature is better than you. You have no knees on which to crawl, and would not fall upon them even if you did, for you have no conception of such a human flaw as mercy. I could even say you fucked your mother, had you one." Roland paused for breath. His three companions were holding theirs. All around them, suffocating, was Blaine the Mono's thunderstruck silence. "I can call you a faithless creature who let your only companion kill herself, a coward who has delighted in the torture of the foolish and the slaughter of the innocent, a lost and bleating mechanical goblin who—" "I command you to stop it, or I'll kill you all right here." Roland's eyes blazed with such wild blue fire that Eddie shrank away from him. Dimly, he heard Jake and Susanna gasp.
"Kill if you will, but command me nothing," the gunslinger roared. "You have forgotten the faces of those who made you. Now either kill us, or be silent and listen to me, Roland of Gilead, son of Stephen, gunslinger and lord of ancient lands. I have not come across all the miles and all the years to listen to your childish prating. Do you understand? Now you will listen to me."
There was another moment of shocked silence. No one breathed. Roland stared sternly forward, his head high, his hand on the butt of his gun. Susanna Dean raised her hand to her mouth and felt the small smile there, as a woman might feel some strange new article of clothing, a hat perhaps, to make sure it is still on straight. She was afraid this was the end of her life, but the feeling which dominated her heart at that moment was not fear, but pride. She glanced to her left and saw Eddie regarding Roland with an amazed grin. Jake's expression was even simpler, pure adoration.
"Tell him," Jake breathed. "Kick his ass, right?"
"You better pay attention," Eddie agreed. "He really doesn't give much of a fuck, Blaine. They don't call him the Mad Dog of Gilead for nothing."
After a long, long moment, Blaine asked, "Did they call you so, Roland, son of Stephen?"
"They may have," Roland replied, standing calmly on thin air above the sterile foothills. "What good are you to me if you won't tell me riddles?" Blaine asked.
Now he sounded like a grumbling, sulky child who has been allowed to stay up too long past his usual bedtime.
"I didn't say we wouldn't," Roland said.
"No?" Blaine sounded bewildered.
"I do not understand. Yet voice print analysis indicates rational discourse. Please explain."
"You said you wanted them right now," the gunslinger replied. "That was what I was refusing. Your eagerness has made you unseemly."
"I don't understand."
"It has made you rude. Do you understand that?" There was a long, thoughtful silence. Centuries had passed since the computer had experienced any human responses other than ignorance, neglect, and superstitious subservience. It had been eons since it had been exposed to simple human courage. Finally, "If what I said struck you as rude, I apologize."
"It is accepted, Blaine, but there is a larger problem."
"Explain."
"Close the carriage again, and I will."
Roland sat down, as if further argument and the prospect of immediate death was now unthinkable. Blaine did as he was asked. The walls filled with color and the nightmare landscape below was once more blotted out. The blip on the route map was now blinking close to the dot marked Candleton.
"All right," Roland said. "Rudeness is forgivable, Blaine, so I was taught in my youth. But I was also taught that stupidity is not."
"How have I been stupid, Roland of Gilead?" Blaine's voice was soft and ominous. Susanna thought of a cat crouched outside a mouse hole, tail swishing back and forth, green eyes shining with malevolence.
"We have something you want," Roland said, "but the only reward you offer if we give it to you is death. That's very stupid."
There was a long, long pause as Blaine thought this over. Then, "What you say is true, Roland of Gilead. But the quality of your riddles is not proven. I will not reward you with your lives for bad riddles." Roland nodded.
"I understand, Blaine. Listen now and take understanding from me. I have told some of this to my friends already. When I was a boy in the Barony of Gilead, there were 7 fair days each year. Winter, wide earth, sowing, midsummer, full earth, reaping, and year's end. Riddling was an important part of every fair day, but it was the most important event of the fair of wide earth and that of full earth, for the riddles told were supposed to augur well or ill for the success of the crops."
"That is superstition with no basis at all in fact," Blaine said. "I find it annoying and upsetting."
"Of course it was superstition," Roland agreed, "but you might be surprised at how well the riddles foresaw the crops. For instance, riddle me this, Blaine. What is the difference between a grandmother and a granary?"
"That is old and not very interesting," Blaine said, but he sounded happy to have something to solve just the same. "One is one's born kin, the other is one's corn bin. A riddle based on phonetic coincidence. Another of this type, one told on the level which contains the Barony of New York, goes like this. What is the difference between a cat and a complex sentence?"
Jake spoke up. "I know. A cat has claws at the end of its paws, and a complex sentence has a pause at the end of its claws."
"Yes," Blaine agreed. "A very silly old riddle, useful only as a mnemonic device."
"For once I agree with you, Blaine, old buddy," Eddie said.
"I am not your buddy, Eddie of New York.
Well, geez, kiss my ass and go to heaven.
There is no heaven. Eddie had no comeback for that one. I would hear more of Fair Day Riddling in Gilead, Roland, son of Stephen.
At noon, on Wide Earth and Full Earth, somewhere between 16 and 30 riddlers would gather in the Hall of the Grandfathers, which was opened for the event. Those were the only times of year when common folk, merchants and farmers and ranchers and such, were allowed into the Hall of the Grandfathers, and on that day they all crowded in.
The gunslinger's eyes were far away and dreamy. It was the expression Jake had seen on his face in that misty other life when Roland had told him of how he and his friends, Cuthbert and Jamie, had once sneaked into the balcony of that same hall to watch some sort of dance party. Jake and Roland had been climbing into the mountains when Roland had told him of that time, close on the trail of Walter.
Martin sat next to my mother and father, Roland had said. I knew them even from so high above, and once she and Martin danced, slowly and revolvingly, and the others cleared the floor for them and clapped when it was over, but the gunslingers did not clap.
Jake looked curiously at Roland, wondering again where this strange man had come from and why.
A great barrel was placed in the center of the floor, Roland went on, and into this each riddler would toss a handful of bark scrolls with riddles writ upon them. Many were old, riddles they had gotten from the elders, even from books in some cases, but many others were new, made up for the occasion. Three judges, one always a gunslinger, would pass on these when they were told aloud, and they were accepted only if the judges deemed them fair.
Yes, riddles must be fair, Blaine agreed.
So they riddled, the gunslinger said.
A faint smile touched his mouth as he thought of those days, days when he had been the age of the bruised boy sitting across from him with the Billy Bumbler in his lap.
For hours on end they riddled. A line was formed down the center of the Hall of the Grandfathers. One's position in this line was determined by lot, and since it was much better to be at the end of the line than at the head, everyone hoped for a high draw, although the winner had to answer at least one riddle correctly.
Of course.
Each man or woman, for some of Gilead's best riddlers were women, approached the barrel, drew a riddle, and if the riddle was still unanswered after the sands in a 3-minute glass had run out, that contestant had to leave the line.
And was the same riddle asked of the next person in the line?
Yes.
So the next person had extra time to think?
Yes.
I see. It sounds pretty swell.
Roland frowned.
Swell?
He means it sounds like fun, Susanna said quietly.
Roland shrugged. It was fun for the onlookers, I suppose, but the contestants took it very seriously. Quite often there were arguments and fistfights after the contest was over and the prize awarded.
What prize was that, Roland, son of Stephen?
The largest goose in Barony. And year after year, my teacher, Court, carried that goose home.
I wish he were here, Blaine said respectfully. He must have been a great riddler.
Indeed he was, Roland said. Are you ready for my proposal, Blaine?
Of course. I will listen with great interest, Roland of Gilead.
Let these next few hours be our fair day. You will not riddle us, for you wish to hear new riddles, not tell some of those millions you already know.
Correct.
We couldn't solve most of them anyway, Roland went on. I'm sure you know riddles that would have stumped even Court had they been pulled out of the barrel.
He was not sure of it at all, but the time to use the fist had passed, and the time to use the feather had come.
Of course, Blaine agreed.
Instead of a goose, our lives shall be the prize, Roland said. We will riddle you as we run, Blaine. If, when we come to Topeka, you have solved every one of our riddles, you may carry out your original plan and kill us. That is your goose. But if we pose you, if there is a riddle in either Jake's book or one of our heads which you don't know and can't answer, you must take us to Topeka and then free us to pursue our quest. That is our goose.
Silence.
Do you understand?
Yes.
Do you agree?
More silence from Blaine the Mono. Eddie sat stiffly with his arm around Susanna, looking up at the ceiling of the barony coach. Susanna's left hand slipped across her belly, stroking the secret which might be hidden there. Jake stroked Oi's fur lightly, avoiding the bloody tangles where the bumbler had been stabbed. They waited while Blaine, the real Blaine, now far behind them, living his quasi-life beneath a city where all the inhabitants lay dead by his hand, considered Roland's proposal.
"Yes," Blaine said at last. "I agree. If I solve all the riddles you ask me, I will take you with me to the place where the path ends in the clearing. If one of you tells a riddle I cannot solve, I will spare your lives and leave you in Topeka, from whence you may continue your quest for the Dark Tower if you so choose. Have I understood the terms and limits of your proposal correctly, Roland, son of Stephen?"
"Yes."
"Very well, Roland of Gilead."
"Very well,
Eddie of New York."
"Very well,
Susanna of New York."
"Very well,
Jake of New York."
"Very well,
Oi of Midworld." Oi looked up briefly at the sound of his name.
"You are Ka-Tet, one made from many."
"So am I."
"Whose Ka-Tet is the stronger is something we must now prove."
There was a moment of silence, broken only by the hard, steady throb of the slow trans turbines bearing them on across the wastelands, bearing them along the path of the beam toward Topeka, where Midworld ended and Endworld began.
"So," cried the voice of Blaine, "cast your nets, wanderers. Try me with your questions, and let the contest begin."
Part 1. Riddles. Chapter 1. Beneath the Demon Moon, 1. 1. The town of Candleton was a poisoned and irradiated ruin, but not dead. After all the centuries, it still twitched with tenebrous life, trundling beetles the size of turtles, birds that looked like small misshapen dragonlets, a few stumbling robots that passed in and out of the rotten buildings like stainless steel zombies, their joints squalling, their nuclear eyes flickering.
"Show your pass, pard,"
cried the one that had been stuck in a corner of the lobby of the Candleton Travelers Hotel for the last 234 years. Embossed on the rusty lozenge of its head was a six-pointed star. It had, over the years, managed to dig a shallow concavity in the steel-sheathed wall blocking its way, but that was all.
"Show your pass, pard."
"Elevated radiation levels possible south and east of town."
"Show your pass, pard."
"Elevated radiation levels possible south and east of town." A bloated rat, blind and dragging its guts behind it in a sack like a rotten placenta, struggled over the posse robot's feet. The posse robot took no notice, just went on butting its steel head into the steel wall.
"Show your pass, pard."
"Elevated radiation levels possible.
Dad rat it and God's cuss it."
Behind it, in the hotel bar, the skulls of men and women who had come in here for one last drink before the cataclysm caught up with them grinned as if they had died laughing. Perhaps some of them had. When Blaine the Mono blammed overhead, running up the night like a bullet running up the barrel of a gun, windows broke, dust sifted down, and several of the skulls disintegrated like ancient pottery vases. Outside, a brief hurricane of radioactive dust blew up the street, and the hitching post in front of the elegant beef and pork restaurant was sucked into the squally updraft like smoke. In the town square, the Candleton fountain split in two, spilling out not water, but only dust, snakes, muty scorpions, and a few of the blindly trundling turtle beetles. Then the shape which had hurtled above the town was gone as if it had never been. Candleton reverted to the moldering activity which had been its substitute for life over the last 2.5 centuries. And then the trailing sonic boom caught up, slamming its thunderclap above the town for the first time in 7 years, causing enough vibration to tumble the mercantile store on the far side of the fountain. The posse robot tried to voice one final warning,
"Elevated rate,"
and then quit for good, facing into its corner like a child that has been bad. 200 or 300 wheels outside Candleton, as one traveled along the path of the beam, the radiation levels and concentrations of DEP-3 in the soil fell rapidly. Here the Mono's track swooped down to less than 10 feet off the ground, and here a doe that looked almost normal walked prettily from piney woods to drink from a stream in which the water had 3/4 cleansed itself. The doe was not normal. A stumpish fifth leg dangled down from the center of her lower belly like a teat, waggling bonelessly to and fro when she walked, and a blind third eye peered milkily from the left side of her muzzle. Yet she was fertile, and her DNA was in reasonably good order for a 12th-generation mutie. In her 6 years of life, she had given birth to 3 live young. 2 of these fawns had been not just viable, but normal, threaded stock, Aunt Talitha of River Crossing would have called them. The third, a skinless, bawling horror, had been killed quickly by its sire. The world, this part of it at any rate, had begun to heal itself. The deer slipped her mouth into the water, began to drink, then looked up, eyes wide, muzzle dripping. Off in the distance she could hear a low humming sound. A moment later it was joined by an eyelash of light. Alarm flared in the doe's nerves, but although her reflexes were fast and the light when first glimpsed was still many wheels away across the desolate countryside, there was never a chance for her to escape. Before she could even begin to fire her muscles, the distant spark had swelled to a searing wolf's eye of light that flooded the stream and the clearing with its glare. With the light came the maddening hum of Blaine's slow trans engines running at full capacity. There was a blur of pink above the concrete ridge which bore the rail, a rooster tail of dust, stones, small dismembered animals, and whirling foliage followed along after. The doe was killed instantly by the concussion of Blaine's passage. Too large to be sucked in the Mono's wake, she was still yanked forward almost 70 yards, with water dripping from her muzzle and hoofs. Much of her hide and the boneless fifth leg was torn from her body and pulled after Blaine like a discarded garment. There was a brief silence, thin as new skin or early ice on a year's end pond. And then the sonic boom came rushing after, like some noisy creature late for a wedding feast, tearing the silence apart, knocking a single mutated bird, it might have been a raven, dead out of the air. The bird fell like a stone and splashed into the stream. In the distance, a dwindling red eye, Blaine's taillight. Overhead, a full moon came out from behind a scrim of cloud, painting the clearing and the stream in the tawdry hues of pawnshop jewelry. There was a face in the moon, but not one upon which lovers would wish to look. It seemed the scant face of a skull, like those in the Candleton Traveler's Hotel, a face which looked upon those few beings still alive and struggling below with the amusement of a lunatic. In Gilead, before the world had moved on, the full moon of year's end had been called the Demon Moon, and it was considered ill luck to look directly at it. Now, however, such did not matter. Now there were demons everywhere. 2. Susanna looked at the route map and saw that the green dot marking their present position was now almost halfway between Candleton and Rylea, Blaine's next stop. Except who's stopping, she thought. From the route map she turned to Eddie. His gaze was still directed up at the ceiling of the Barony coach. She followed it and saw a square which could only be a trap door, except when you were dealing with futuristic shit like a talking train, she supposed you called it a hatch or something even cooler. Stenciled on it was a simple red drawing which showed a man stepping through the opening. Susanna tried to imagine following the implied instruction and popping up through that hatch at over 800 miles an hour. She got a quick but clear image of a woman's head being ripped from her neck like a flower from its stalk. She saw the head flying backward along the length of the Barony coach, perhaps bouncing once, and then disappearing into the dark, eyes staring and hair rippling. She pushed the picture away as fast as she could. The hatch up there was almost certainly locked shut anyway. Blaine the Mono had no intention of letting them go. They might win their way out, but Susanna didn't think that was a sure thing, even if they managed to stump Blaine with a riddle. "Sorry to say this, but you sound like just one more honky motherfucker to me, honey," she thought in a mental voice that was not quite Detta Walker's. "I don't trust your mechanical ass. You apt to be more dangerous, beaten, than with a blue ribbon pinned to your memory banks." Jake was holding his tattered book of riddles out to the gunslinger as if he no longer wanted the responsibility of carrying it. Susanna knew how the kid must feel. Their lives might very well be in those grimy, well-thumbed pages. She wasn't sure she would want the responsibility of holding onto it either. "Roland," Jake whispered, "do you want this?"
"Aunt," Oi said, giving the gunslinger a forbidding glance. "Olin on this?"
The bumbler fixed his teeth on the book, took it from Jake's hand, and stretched his disproportionately long neck toward Roland, offering him riddledy-dum, brain-twisters and puzzles for everyone. Roland glanced at it for a moment, his face distant and preoccupied, then shook his head.
"Not yet."
He looked forward at the route map. Blaine had no face, so the map had to serve them as a fixing point. The flashing green dot was closer to Rylea now. Susanna wondered briefly what the countryside through which they were passing looked like, and decided she didn't really want to know, not after what they'd seen as they left the city of Lod.
"Blaine?" Roland called.
"Yes?"
"Can you leave the room? We need to confer."
"You nuts if you think he's gonna do that," Susanna thought, but Blaine's reply was quick and eager.
"Yes, gunslinger. I will turn off all my sensors in the Barony coach. When your conference is done and you are ready to begin the riddling, I will return."
"Yeah, you and General MacArthur," Eddie muttered.
"What did you say, Eddie of New York?"
"Nothing. Talking to myself, that's all."
"To summon me, simply touch the route map," said Blaine. "As long as the map is red, my sensors are off."
"See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. Don't forget to write."
A pause, then,
"Olive oil, but not castoria."
The route map rectangle at the front of the cabin suddenly turned a red so bright Susanna couldn't look at it without squinting.
"Olive oil, but not castoria?" Jake asked. "What the heck does that mean?"
"It doesn't matter," Roland said. "We don't have much time. The mono travels just as fast toward its point of ending, whether Blaine's with us or not."
"You don't really believe he's gone, do you?"
Eddie asked. "A slippery pup like him? Come on, get real. He's peeking, I guarantee you."
"I doubt it very much," Roland said. And Susanna decided she agreed with him, for now at least. You could hear how excited he was at the idea of riddling again after all these years.
And he's confident," Susanna said. "Don't expect to have much trouble with the likes of us."
"Will he?"
Jake asked the gunslinger.
"Will he have trouble with us?"
"I don't know," Roland said. "I don't have a watch me hidden up my sleeve, if that's what you're asking. It's a straight game. But at least it's a game I've played before. We've all played it before, at least to some extent. And there's that." He nodded toward the book, which Jake had taken back from Oi. "There are forces at work here. Big ones. And not all of them are working to keep us away from the tower." Susanna heard him, but it was Blaine she was thinking of. Blaine, who had gone away and left them alone, like the kid who's been chosen it, obediently covering his eyes while his playmates hide. And wasn't that what they were, Blaine's playmates? The thought was somehow worse than the image she'd had of trying the escape hatch and having her head torn off.
"So what do we do?" Eddie asked. "You must have an idea, or you never would have sent them away."
His great intelligence, coupled with his long period of loneliness and forced inactivity, may have combined to make him more human than he knows. That's my hope, anyway. First, we must establish a kind of geography. We must tell, if we can, where he is weak and where he is strong, where he is sure of the game and where not so sure. Riddles are not just about the cleverness of the riddler, never think it. They are also about the blind spots of he who is riddled.
Does he have blind spots? Eddie asked.
If he doesn't, Roland said calmly, we're going to die on this train.
I like the way you kind of ease us over to rough spots, Eddie said with a thin smile. It's one of your many charms.
We will riddle him 4 times to begin with, Roland said. Easy, not so easy, quite hard, very hard. He'll answer all 4, of that I am confident. But we will be listening for how he answers.
Eddie was nodding, and Susanna felt a small, almost reluctant glimmer of hope. It sounded like the right approach, all right.
Then we'll send him away again and hold palaver, the gunslinger said. Mayhap we'll get an idea of what direction to send our horses. These first riddles can come from anywhere, but, he nodded gravely toward the book, based on Jake's story of the bookstore, the answer we really need should be in there, not in any memories I have of fair day riddlings.
Must be in there.
Question, Susanna said.
Roland looked at her, eyebrows raised over his faded, dangerous eyes.
It's a question we're looking for, not an answer, she said. This time it's the answers that are apt to get us killed.
The gunslinger nodded. He looked puzzled, frustrated even, and this was not an expression Susanna liked seeing on his face. But this time when Jake held out the book, Roland took it. He held it for a moment. Its faded but still gay red cover looked very strange in his big sunburned hands, especially in the right one with its essential reduction of 2 fingers, then passed it on to Eddie.
You're easy, Roland said, turning to Susanna.
Perhaps, she replied with a trace of a smile, but it's still not a very polite thing to say to a lady, Roland.
He turned to Jake. You'll go second with one that's a little harder. I'll go 3rd. You'll go last, Eddie. Pick one from the book that looks hard.
The hard ones are toward the back, Jake supplied.
But none of your foolishness, mind. This is life and death. The time for foolishness is past.
Eddie looked at him, old, long, tall, and ugly, who'd done God knew how many ugly things in the name of reaching his tower, and wondered if Roland had any idea at all of how much that hurt. Just that casual admonition not to behave like a child, grinning and cracking jokes now that their lives were at wager. He opened his mouth to say something, an Eddie Dean special, something that would be both funny and stinging at the same time, the kind of remark that always used to drive his brother Henry dog shit, and then closed it again. Maybe Long, Tall, and Ugly was right. Maybe it was time to put away the one-liners and dead baby jokes. Maybe it was finally time to grow up.
3. After 3 more minutes of murmured consultation and some quick flipping through riddledy-dum on Eddie's and Susanna's parts, Jake already knew the one he wanted to try Blaine with first, he'd said. Roland went to the front of the barony coach and laid his hand on the fiercely glowing rectangle there. The route map reappeared at once. Although there was no sensation of movement now that the coach was closed, the green dot was closer to Rylea than ever.
So, Roland, son of Stephen, Blaine said.
To Eddie, he sounded more than jovial, he sounded next door to hilarious.
Is your quartet ready to begin?